didn't they tell me this before you got here? How come this is the case? Well, you're married to one. You're living in adultery to 29. And does that go for the other 17 that are promised to me when they get old enough? We went around the world as missionaries, making them all like us. And you see all these tribesmen wearing the little three-piece suits, threadbare, that have been sent to them by stateside preachers when they got too worn out for them to wear. They went with the same missionary fervor. I'm going to keep talking. I'm sorry, we're leaving some stations, but I got to keep going. Cecil Rhodes was one of these. He copied in longhand the inaugural lecture of Rhodes and took it with him for 30 years. Rhodes feverishly exploited the diamond and gold fields of South Africa, rose to be prime minister of the Cape Colony, contributed money to political parties, controlled parliamentary seats in England and South Africa, sought to win a strip of British territory across Africa from the Cape of Good Hope to Egypt, and joined these two extremes together with a telegraph line, ultimately with a Cape to Cairo railway. Rhodes inspired devoted support for his goals from others in South Africa and in England. With financial support from Lord Rothschild, he was able to monopolize the diamond mines of South Africa as De Beers consolidated mines, build up a great mining enterprise, gold, that is, as consolidated gold fields. And in the middle 1890s, Rhodes had a personal income of at least £1 million a year, that's about $5 million then, which was spent so freely for his mysterious purposes that he was usually overdrawn on his account. And these purposes centered on his desire to federate the English-speaking peoples and bring all the habitable portions of the world under their control. One man wanting to bring or federate the English-speaking peoples of the world and bring all the habitable portions of the world under their control. Now, this wasn't white versus black. He wanted the Germans under his control, the Italians under his control. English-speaking people should rule the world. That was his view. Now, don't revolve my face. Just count me down to when I'm on in the other city, and I'll take a breath and keep going. For this purpose, Rhodes left part of his fortune to found the Rhodes Scholarships at Oxford in order to spread the English ruling class tradition throughout the English-speaking world as Ruskin had wanted. I asked this the other night. How many of you know, as the media gets all giddy over Rhodes Scholars, that that's why it was founded and funded? Rhodes Scholars are supposed to perpetuate Cecil Rhodes' ambition to federate English-speaking people of the world and rule everybody else. Now, we just joined Reno and some other cities. Now, I'm talking about South Africa and its backgrounds. Tragedy and Hope is the book, The History of the World in Our Time, by Carol Quigley, former professor at Georgetown University. John Ruskin lectured at Oxford. He gave a moral imperative to the privileged classes of England. If they didn't take their privilege, their ways, what they were trained into being, to the downtrodden masses of England and to the rest of the world, non-English, they would lose their privilege and furthermore wouldn't deserve to have it, because in essence he implied they were given these fine arts as trustees to take them to the world. Cecil Rhodes, the power in Southern Africa, taking home eventually an income in 1890 of $5 million a year, overdrawing his accounts constantly for his purposes, was imbibed with this philosophy. The desire to federate the English-speaking peoples of the world and bring all the habitable portions of the world under their control. For this purpose, he left part of his fortune to fund the Rhodes Scholarship at Oxford in order to spread the English ruling class tradition throughout the English-speaking world as Ruskin had wanted. And we're going to see he formed the Round Tables. The Round Table became the leading foreign relations society of England. Round Tables in America, he founded them in all these English-speaking countries. Produced the Council on Foreign Relations, which in turn produced the Trilateral Commission. You can count on one hand the secretaries of state in the last 30 years that have not come under this influence. Now let's go on. Among Ruskin's most devoted disciples at Oxford were a group of intimate friends. I'm going to read the ones I know you'll know, including Arnold Toynbee, Lord Milner, Philip Lyttelton, Sir Henry Birchenough. These were so moved by Ruskin, along with Rhodes, that they devoted the rest of their lives to carrying out his ideas, this great moral imperative. A similar group of Cambridge men, including Reginald Balliol, Brett, Lord Esser, Sir John B. Seeley, Albert Lord Grey, and Edmund Garrett were also aroused by Ruskin's message and devoted their lives to extension of the British Empire and uplift of England's urban masses as two parts of one project they called the Extension of the English-Speaking Idea. You're starting to get a hint of why the Afrikaners, presently in power in South Africa, speak Afrikaans and resist the dominance of English-speaking. I mean, some people are just getting acquainted with South Africa, and they expected every spokesman from South Africa to get up and speak in Oxford-style English. Have you looked at enough interviews and newscasts to notice the accent on most of the South African leadership? The Dutch accent? The Afrikaners were the Dutch settlers. They rebelled against English rule in the Boer War. They were the early farmers. You read Missioners of the Covenant. They carried a Bible under one arm, fleeing Catholic prosecution, along with the French Huguenots, settling in South Africa, reading the Bible, and convinced, as the Puritans were convinced when they came to America, that they were the new Israel. These Protestants went to South Africa convinced that they were the modern Israel, and they would not act without reading the Old Testament. And they concluded, one of them felt it was a revelation, that they were the Israel of South Africa, and that the natives they encountered were the Canaanites. And they were to treat them as Joshua and his troops treated the dwellers in the land of Canaan. And as the chosen people, and you will never find more legalistic people than the Dutch Reformed Church in South Africa. Botta belongs to that church. I'm quite sure he'd be very pained at my liberal theological views. They are God's chosen people as surely as the Jews in Israel and the Puritans in America. And the British came and were viewed as the usurpers. And the Boer War took out. And there are many of those in Dutch South Africa that will say the only difference between them and the Americans is we won the revolution, they lost it. There's not just black versus white. There's Dutch versus English. And because so much of the moral pressure on them is coming from England, in a sense, the hardliners among the Dutch Afrikan Party see this as but a repeat of the frame of reference that brought the Boer War. It's the British trying to impose their, it's the English-speaking world trying to impose their standard on the chosen people of South Africa. Those fundamentalists in that frame view are meddling the same way. Now, Newsman will quote the section of a policeman throwing his rubber bullwhip on news people and saying, "You damn meddlers, get out of here. You're causing the trouble more than anybody else, and if you come back next tomorrow, we'll shoot you." They see that as a attack on the press. That ain't the way the Dutch view it. That's their frustration with people who have no desire to learn what the real issues are, and they see them as meddlers. They view the English-speaking attempt to impose its standard on everybody the same way the Jew views a Christian missionary trying to convert them. And unless you can come to grips with that emotion and you reduce it down to simple, unified state of mind in the United States, black versus white, you miss the whole issue. And if Botta isn't given a chance to try to do some constructive change, his predecessor will be either the fascistic right, not his predecessor, his successor, will be either the fascistic right or the communistic left. And there'll be bloodshed in either case. If the fascistic right takes over, their philosophy is bulldoze some of those black settlements to the ground and shoot them all. And I see that as an evil to be avoided, just like I see it an evil to be avoided with teenage gangs shooting and killing indiscriminately all white folk, including some that are probably on their side. Not a race issue. The English-speaking idea must be extended. They were remarkably successful in these aims because England's most sensational journalist, William T. Stead, an ardent social reformer and imperialist, brought them into association with Rhodes. This association was formally established on February 5, 1891, almost 40 years after the Civil War. They're just getting started with this plan. When Rhodes instead organized a secret society of which Rhodes had been dreaming for 16 years. In this secret society, Rhodes was to be the leader. Stead, Brett, Lord Esher, and Milner were to form an executive committee. One leader, three elitists, executive committee. Then Arthur, Lord Balfour of the Balfour Declaration fame that opened Israel to the Jews, Sir Harry Johnston, Lord Rothschild, Albert Lord Grey, and others were listed as potential members of a circle of initiates, while there was to be an outer circle known as the Association of Helpers. This is not race classification, but it's a form of stratification. And when Lord Rothschild and Lord Balfour are in the third ring, that's elitism par excellence in there in the executive committee and where Cecil Rhodes dwelt. It's an English form of the apartheid. The walls are not quite as thick, but they're still there. We're still talking about power. We're talking about the ins versus the outs. Brett was invited to join this organization, the Association of Helpers. That was the outer circle. The outer circle was known as the Association of Helpers, later organized by Milner as the Round Table Organization. You know, there are people in America that scream and cry and say, Council on Foreign Relations runs this country. Well, even closer to the core of those elitist one-world thinkers that have almost unlimited funds and are forever with a sense of moral imperative planning what's best for all of us. Behind the Council on Foreign Relations is the roundtable organizations. And behind them, circles, circles, circles to the inner core. People we never hear about in the organization. Brett was invited to join this organization the same day, and Milner a couple of weeks later on his return from Egypt. Both accepted with enthusiasm. Thus, the central part of the secret society was established in March 1891. It continued to function... Am I boring you? It continued to function as a formal group, though the outer circle was apparently not organized until 1909 to 1913. See, I don't even like to collect stamps after 1900 because they're just too recent. The outer circle, the roundtable organization, wasn't organized really until 1909 to 1913. This group was able to get access to Rhodes' money after his death in 1902, and also to the funds of loyal Rhodes supporters like Alfred Beat and Sir Abe Bailey. With this backing, they sought to extend and execute the ideals that Rhodes had obtained from Ruskin instead. Milner was the chief Rhodes trustee, and Parkin was organizing secretary of the Rhodes Trust after 1902, while Gell and Birchenough, as well as others with similar ideas, became officials of the British South Africa Company. They were joined in their efforts by other Ruskinite friends of Stead's, like Lord Grey, Lord Esher, and Flora Shaw, later Lady Lugard. In 1890, by a stratagem too elaborate to describe here, and he'd already been pretty elaborate, Miss Shaw became head of the colonial department of the Times while still remaining on the payroll of Stead's Pall Mall Gazette. Now the press gets in it. In this post, she played a major role in the next 10 years in carrying into execution the imperial schemes of Cecil Rhodes, to whom Stead had introduced her in 1889. In the meantime, in 1884, acting under Ruskin's inspiration, a group which included Arnold Toynbee, Milner, Gell, Gray, Seeley, Michael Glazebrook, founded the First Settlement House, an organization by which educated upper-class people could live in the slums in order to assist, instruct, and guide the poor, with particular emphasis on social welfare and adult education. The new enterprise, set up in East London with P.L. Gell as chairman, was named Toynbee Hall, after Arnold Toynbee, who died, age 31, in 1883. Let me keep going. This was the original model for the thousands of settlement houses, such as Hull House in Chicago, now found throughout the world, and was one of the seeds from which the modern movement for adult education and university extension courses grew. As Governor General and High Commissioner of South Africa in the period 1897 to 1905, 4 years after the death of Rhodes, Milner recruited a group of young men, chiefly from Oxford and from Toynbee Hall, to assist him in organizing his administration, Governor General and High Commissioner of South Africa. In the stream of the Ruskinites, driven with the moral imperative to anglicize the world, with the money of Rhodes and other trusts, now tied in by some intricate connections with leading voices on leading newspapers, Milner as the Governor General and High Commissioner of South Africa, 1897 to 1905, recruited a group of young men, chiefly from Oxford and from Toynbee Hall to assist him in organizing his administration. Through his brain trust, he was the Kennedy of South Africa. Through his influence, these men were able to win influential posts in government and international finance and became the dominant influence in British imperial and foreign affairs up to 1939. Under Milner in South Africa, they were known as Milner's Kindergarten until 1910. In 1909 to 1913, they organized semi-secret groups known as round table groups in the chief British dependencies and the United States. These groups still function today in 8 countries. They kept in touch with each other by personal correspondence and frequent visits, and through an influential quarterly magazine. When I was at Stanford University, they sent me the magazine and asked me to join. The Round Table, founded in 1910 and largely supported by Sir Abe Bailey's money, was that magazine. In 1919, they founded the Royal Institute of International Affairs, Chatham House, for which the chief financial supporters were Sir Abe Bailey and the Astor family. Money. Owners of the Times. Similar institutes of international affairs were established in the chief British dominions and in the United States, where the organization that is the counterpart to the Royal Institute of International Affairs in the United States is known as the Council on Foreign Relations. These were all founded in the period 1919 to 27. After 1925, a somewhat similar structure of organizations, known as the Institute of Pacific Relations, was set up in 12 countries holding territory in the Pacific area, the units in each British dominion existing on an interlocking basis with the Round Table Group and the Royal Institute of International Affairs in the same country. In Canada, the nucleus of this group consisted of Milner's undergraduate friends at Oxford, such as Arthur Glazebrook and George Parkin, while in South Africa and India, the nucleus was made up of former members of Milner's kindergarten. These included Sir Patrick Duncan, B.K. Long, Richard Feedham, and Sir Dougal Malcolm in South Africa, and Sir William Maris, James Lord Meston, and their friend Malcolm Lord Haley in India. The groups in Australia and New Zealand had been recruited by Stead himself through his magazine, The Review of Reviews, as early as 1890 and 1893, by Parkin as at Milner's instigation in the period 1889 to 1910, and by Lionel Curtis, also at Milner's request, in 1910 to 1919. Now, Lionel Curtis is important. Liberalism was the theology that predominated. The Anglican Church had swung over to liberalism. The American churches had swung over to liberalism. At the turn of the century, the what is now called charismatic, then Pentecostal revival hit the world and gave a new strength to the fundamentalist wing of the church. And the First World War and the Industrial Revolution, the Second World War caused the leading liberal thinkers, Karl Barth, Emil Brunner, Paul Tillich, Reinhold Niebuhr, H. Richard Niebuhr, to suddenly recognize their liberal theology was being blown apart by the sinfulness of educated man, and neo-orthodoxy burst on the scene. But all these thought patterns were influencing the anglicized version, and at this time, Lionel Curtis, the leading exponent of liberalism, gave a theological justification for what Ruskin had given in philosophic terms, but that comes later. I warn you. The power and influence of this Rhodes Milner group in British imperial affairs and in foreign policy since 1889, though not widely recognized, can hardly be exaggerated. We might mention as an example that this group dominated the Times in London from 1890 to 1912 and has controlled it completely since 1912, except for the years 1919 to 22. Because the Times has been owned by the Astor family since 1922, this Rhodes-Milner group was sometimes spoken of as the Clevedon set, named after the Astor country house where they sometimes assembled. Numerous other papers and journals have been under the control or influence of this group since 1889. Our Foreign Affairs magazine comes out of the Council on Foreign Relations. I went through undergraduate history, prepared for and toyed with the idea of applying for Fulbright scholarship at the American University in Beirut on geopolitical studies in the Middle East, read for the political science prof, read foreign affairs like a Bible without knowing any of this, that it came from a particular frame of reference. They have established and influenced numerous university and other chairs of imperial affairs and international relations. Some of these are the Beatt chairs at Oxford, the Montague Burton chair at Oxford, the Rhodes chair at London, the Stevenson chair at Chatham House, the Wilson chair, and others, as well as such important source of influence as Rhodes House at Oxford. I mean, we've got a brain trust organized. From 1884 to about 1915, the members of this group worked valiantly to extend the British Empire and to organize it in a federal system. They were constantly harping on the lessons to be learned from the failure of the American Revolution and the success of the Canadian Federation of 1867, and hoped to federate the various parts of the empire as seemed feasible, then confederate the whole of it with the United Kingdom into a single organization. They also hoped to bring the United States into this organization to whatever degree was possible. Stead was able to get Rhodes to accept in principle a solution which might have made Washington the capital of the whole organization, or allow parts of the empire to become states of the American Union. The varied character of the British imperial possessions, the backwardness of many of the native peoples involved, the independence of many of the white colonists overseas, and the growing international tension which culminated in the First World War made it impossible to carry out the plan for imperial federation, although the five colonies in Australia were joined into the Commonwealth of Australia in 1901, and the four colonies in South Africa were joined into the Union of South Africa in 1910. Now we're getting closer. Am I boring you? Well, let's see. I want to take all this time. Egypt and the Sudan. Disraeli's purchase with Rothschild money of 176,602 shares of Suez Canal stock for £3,680,000 from Egypt in 1875 was motivated by concern for the British communications with India. Just as the British acquisition of the Cape of Good Hope in 1814 had resulted from the same concern. But in imperial matters, one step leads to another, and every acquisition obtained to protect an earlier acquisition requires a new advance at a later date to protect it. This was clearly true in Africa, where such motivations gradually extended British control southward from Egypt and northward from the Cape, until these were joined in Central Africa with the conquest of German Tanganyika in 1916. Now, needing the gateways, they purchased the Cape of Good Hope. They purchased control of the Suez Canal. Now, to protect those two interests, they begin to move in a pincer movement into Central Africa. The British were still carrying out their mission. East Central Africa, south and east of the Sudan, the struggle for a British Africa was largely in the hands of H.H. Sir Harry Johnston. Let me skip over him. Kitchener's Railway from Egypt to Uganda. South Africa. This is getting pretty complicated. You want to go into it this much? The decade 1919 to 1929 is the decade when the Rose-Milner Group gave the chief impetus toward transforming the British Empire into the Commonwealth of Nations. The creation of the roundtable groups from Milner's kindergarten in 1909 to 1913 opened a new day in both these fields, although the whole group was so secretive that even today many close students of the subject are not aware of its significance. We're leaving some cities. Do you want me to continue on it? It's pretty heavy stuff. You want me to go on? Do you want me to go on, you who watch on TV? That's pretty heavy stuff. We're going to get into Lionel Curtis's work now. During the decade 1919 to 1929, the year I was born, I'm the only man in the world born in 1929 that's 45. The Rhodes-Milner Group gave the chief impetus toward transforming the British Empire into the Commonwealth of Nations. Now, all of this will be all very good background when I return to teaching on the Lost Tribes, too. And launching India on the road to responsible self-government. The creation of the roundtable groups of Milner's kindergarten in 1909 to 13 opened a new day in both these fields. Although the whole group was so secretive that even today, many close students of the subject are not aware of its significance. These men had formed their intellectual growth at Oxford on Pericles' funeral oration as described in a book by a member of the group, Sir Alfred Zimmerman's The Greek Commonwealth, on Edmund Burke's On Conciliation with America, on J.B. Seeley's Growth of British Policy, on A.V. Dicey's The Law and Custom of the Constitution, and on the New Testament's Sermon on the Mount. These were the textbooks that finished nailing the lid tight on the Ruskin imperative. The last was especially the influence of Lionel Curtis, and it was influential on him. He, Lionel Curtis, had a fanatical conviction that with the proper spirit and the proper organization, local self-government and federalism, the kingdom of God could be established on earth. He was sure that if people were trusted just a bit beyond what they deserved, they would respond by proving worthy of such trust. Now, let's chew that one around a while. If you're not smart enough to have already figured out where the modern media gets most of its ideas under a new frame of reference, they no longer are on some kind of English-speaking imperative, is no longer open and outwardly and blatantly a Ruskin ideal and a Cecil Rhodes dream of a federated, anglicized world dominated by English-speaking people, bringing everyone into the cultural growth to the ideal for man, which was embodied in the well-trained, privileged class of the English-speaking world. For example, they lost the American Revolution because an English gentleman wouldn't fight unfairly. He marched down the road like proper gentlemen, and you shoot your opponent in the face. It just ain't proper to sneak up behind them and shoot their dead carcass from the back or snipe at them from the brush. Gentlemen don't do that. You stop for tea in the middle of the afternoon. You set up a little civilization in the middle of the jungle. You don't become like the natives. They become like you. And when they prove they're like you, they get baptized into society with all the benefits thereof. Sounds like a fundamentalist church, doesn't it? Now, are you already figuring out that the modern press has taken that idea and made it a one-world philosophy, and instead of English-speaking people making people like them, the press makes everybody like them, regardless of the language you speak. And democracy has become the buzzword. You just have, if people were trusted just a bit beyond what they deserve, they would respond by proving worthy of such trust. You give all these downtrodden masses one man, one vote, and they'll be fair with their former rulers. They'll hang you fairly high. If people were trusted just a bit beyond what they deserve, they would respond by proving worthy of such trust. Christian. As he wrote in The Problems of a Commonwealth in 1916, if political power is granted to groups before they are fit, they will tend to rise to the need. I want to try that again. If political power, he said, is granted to groups before they are fit, they will tend to rise to the need. You just throw them in the pool, they'll swim. Now, isn't that basically what's being argued? You know, I'm sorry, it has nothing to do with race. I want to tell you, if whites had been treated the way the blacks and the coloreds and the Indians have been treated in South Africa over the last 50 years, they wouldn't do such a hot job running a complicated society either. It had nothing to do with race. Race has been used as a rationale to keep the status quo. Now, the descendants of the Boers, the Dutch Africans, resisted this. They came up with the idea that South Africa is the world eclectically in a little microcosm. And instead of that viewpoint that everyone should be made over in our image, including the Afrikaners being made over in the Englishman image, they began to polarize and preach the value of culture as it is. And they therefore would create a nation that would sectionalize 10 different cultures so that the Zulus could be here and the Hoo-Hoos could be there and the What-What could be there and the Englishmen here and the Dutchmen there. In short, preserve the culture. And the mix is so bad it's too late now to figure out who ought to live where. So you just sit down and divide the nation up into spots. And you say, this tribe's going to live here. Well, but I live in Cape Town. Well, it doesn't matter. We're going to transfer. You can't own land anywhere except here. Out here in San Bernardino. We're going to call San Bernardino Pentecostal. You can own land if you're a Pentecostal in San Bernardino only. You work your whole life, you can have retirement, but you can only get your retirement if you move to San Bernardino, live where Pentecostals have a nation. Now, if we can get you all to move there, eventually we'll give you your independence, and San Bernardino will become the grand nation of Pentecostals. You know I'm being ludicrous, drawing an analogy. And the Baptists, they're going to live in Death Valley. So, we will give you immediate citizenship, issue passports for Death Valley. Now, you can live here with a green card and work. But your national homeland where Baptists will help one another forever look alike like Baptists is Death Valley. And when you get done working, we'll give you your retirement, but you can only collect it in Death Valley. In the interest of making sure that each distinct group develops as a group, and no more of this crap of deciding that everybody's going to suddenly become like us, we're going to protect individuality of these groups and force you to live in your own territory, develop your own culture, and don't change at all. Now, sin moves in. It becomes a rationale. You can figure out who gets the best, you know, best property. Now, I know the Jews have been downtrodden, but when their good old brother Joseph took over in Egypt, he gave his brother, and when the famine came, they came down there. Memphis, best part of Egypt. There were a bunch of damned Egyptians mad, too. And they festered until they got the Pharaoh in Upper Egypt, come down, kicked the living daylights out of Jews. The rulers fled and built cities elsewhere in Troy, and Chalco went over to Athens. And some of Zara's sons went to Spain. Bless their ever-living heart. They made slaves out of them for the big... former big shot, till Moses came along with God's help, killed enough the Egyptians, put enough frogs and lice on them, they said, get out of here. It's always a battle of the ins and outs. The only way the Africans can keep from being Englishmen is develop that philosophy. It was abused. I doubt very many of our senators are as motivated by moral issues as votes. Power is the name of the game. You just figure out ways to put a moral meaning on your sinful ways. You rationalize the deed that's necessary to preserve yourself in your view of what you ought to be. And God's made us feel guilty about our self perpetuation. So we come up with these highfalutin rationales. We got a bunch of rich kids, smart and well-trained with nothing to do but play poker and pool and talk and make tea. The older son gets all the estate. Now, he's got to go out here and carve out something for himself out there in the world. And we're too educated and sophisticated to do anything so crass as to say, damn it, I want a share of this world. I want to line my pockets with gold so I can live the easy life. So I can flip the grand old American eagle, which didn't yet exist, to my brother that got it off my dad. I prayed he'd die every day before he'd got the inheritance. And he got everything. I used to be, we grew up, went to the same school together. Daddy treated us all alike. We all had big expense accounts. We were the big shots. And we'd drive in our carriage through London. Look at all them poor people. Well, God knew we deserved it. That's why we got it. And then, just because this guy came out the gate, before I did, and Mama dropped him a few months before I fell out.